Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island since 1988. Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find 312 Wheat Ale, Big Juicy Beer Hug, and so many other limited releases at either of Goose's locations in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, Sound Opinions listeners. If you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
One, two, tres, cuatro.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking about South African music with author and journalist Lior Phillips. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Koch. We're talking about the formative music of the past and present of South Africa. Let's jump in.
Throughout the years, you know, Greg, we've done a couple of these world tour episodes when we've talked about music from a particular country that listeners here may not have been very familiar with. This week, we're diving deep into the popular music of South Africa that we want to mention here. This is not all the music of South Africa. It's just a very good place to start. What a rich tradition.
Absolutely right, Jim. And we've got a great guide to take us on the tour today, South African journalist and author of the 33 and a third book, South African Popular Music, Lior Phillips. Lior, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's so lovely to meet both of you.
Well, and congrats on this book. I mean, talk about ambitious. The yeah. Title, South African Popular Music. You'd think it should be, 18, 24 inches thick and, you know, a doorstop. But it's not. You tackled this vast topic, Lior, mm-hmm. in a very colorful and engaging way, which is to say by zooming in on key artists along the way, giving us these lovely vignettes of wonderful songs and incredible artists.
It's an impossible, extraordinary task to even think of starting from the 40s and ending up till now, because now is still happening in all its glory. Yeah. And so that's why the book kind of went from the title Pop Music to Popular Music. It originally was proposed as just talking about South African pop. And the more I got into it, the more stories that I researched, it was like that bug. I couldn't stop researching. And my editors let right. me run with it. So that's essentially what happened and how I landed up here. And I definitely mourn the loss of many of the artists that I had to leave off and hope that I can attribute and celebrate them in the future somehow.
Well, it's a great overview for somebody. A lot of people may know cursory artists, you know, from the South African musical scene. You really dive a little, quite a bit deeper than that and give us a really nice overview of the last century, really, of that music. And, you know, your accent, your lovely accent, you're from Cape Town originally, is that right?
Yes, I'm from Cape Town, South Africa originally, born and bred.
So you grew up with this music, Lior?
I did. It was kind of impossible not to. Mm. It was, I think, only in the late 90s, early 2000s that there was a lot of shift into radio play, skewing more towards local. But even just walking into kind of our local 7-Eleven style store, you'd hear Bongo Muffin, you'd hear everything that I speak about in the book, you'd just hear it playing because that's what people wanted to listen to. You'd hear it in the taxis driving by, you'd hear it played at somebody's house. It was such celebratory and yet a deeply rooted political music that you couldn't get away from it.
And both black and white audiences embraced the music?
I'm not sure about the word embrace. I certainly think that there was a lot of interest. but we certainly, our ear definitely lent to it, because think about it this way, there's people singing in Zulu, Xhosa, they're singing in many different languages. There's 11 different languages in South Africa.
Yeah, you make the point that there's so many different languages that one of the only things that united these diverse peoples was music.
Exactly. And that sounds as cliche as it comes, but music as a powerful tool in unification in a country that has been seen as this singular monolith is extraordinary. So if you think about it, I wanted to really make sure that the reader understood that music is about identity as much as it is about, you know, community. And I think that people just listening, you can't escape another language. You're not gonna turn your head at it and your heart at it, because music of another language, it's got to say something as rich as our very limited English, you know. And I think that I learned that at a very young age. And I didn't have Google and things, you know, this was like the late 80s. I didn't have Google to look it up. So you just asked who you knew, or you just relied on melody to move your body and move you along. And luckily, African music is steeped in that. So it makes it easier.
Well, it's extraordinary, too, to give us this overview. And, you know, your book begins in a place that I think is totally appropriate with Solomon Linda. That song spans a century, really. I mean, it's had a lifespan that has just gone on and on. And in the process of writing that chapter, you get into some serious issues of appropriation and, you know, how cultures have taken South African music, other cultures, and appropriated the music, but built on this foundation. So take us there. Take us to Solomon Linda and 1939.
Solomon Linda's Evening Birds, the origin of the song's name, of Mbube, became an entire genre. And I think that's first and foremost the most incredibly astonishing thing, because I don't know what another example of that is. You know, the entire genre of music is now named after that one song. And you've got these multi-part male vocal complex harmonies and this beautiful, I was just listening to it actually again this morning, this unified rhythm. Then it's got this soaring solo that makes you feel like you are in that room. That's what this genre stands for. There's so many other songs that could be a good example of the genre, but I thought if you're speaking about popular music, if you're speaking about a history within a country, this is a great way to start. You know, it means lion in Zulu. You're getting that animalistic rawness of what music is at the core. And it's really just a song about, as far as my research goes, you know, calling out a lion during a hunt, which is very typified in what, if you both had to close your eyes, or any listener listening had to close their eyes and think of Africa, you think of political poverty, you think of this darkness because of colonialism, and you think of safari. And this takes, it flips that on its head, because now you're in it. You're not just the viewer and the spectator. You are part of the story, which is what the genre really stands for.
Well, and of course, Western audiences would come to know it as The Lion Sleeps Tonight or Whim Away. How did that song cross the oceans, cross cultures, and become a Western hit while completely erasing the South African roots? You know? I mean, you build on that extraordinary reporting Rolling Stone did about two decades ago. That's one of those pieces that strikes me, Greg. It was a brilliant, brilliant reportage on the history of that song. And Lior adds to it, fleshes it out. And it always makes me feel, if only Rolling Stone did this more. Yeah. Why is it so rare to have this level of rebuttal? So tell us, Lior.
I love referencing that Rolling Stone to the point where I was almost like, do I need to write an entire chapter? Because that piece was so revolutionary. And I didn't read it when it came out, only later. Mm. And then rereading it now within the context that we are living now with, you know, later we'll get to it, I'm a Piano and Kwaito. It just was, for lack of a better word, quite emotional. And, you know, Solomon Linda worked at a Gallo Records packing plant. Gallo Records is a famous South African record label, and was overheard apparently singing, you know, according to this legend. And Pete Seeg and the Weavers then heard the record, did a version that's called Whim Away, and then multiple other covers later, including The Tokens, you know, whose Lion Sleeps Tonight became such a big hit. And Linda, because if you think about how diluted then that process is, Linda got next to no money from any of those sales, but he led the Evening Birds to, you know, people still knew and adored and loved them. And he always had this tight, they had this tight choreography and the high fashion attire. And it was just a really cool way to showcase early pop stardom on a local scene, I think. Even if they didn't get any money, which, to be honest, is just the first introduction of such escapades.
Yeah, well, and then ultimately Disney, you know, in 94, right? The Lion King.
Yeah.
You know, the final blow, the multi-million dollar enterprise. And here's this guy, you know, working this, you know, working class dude at the start of it all, just completely erased from the storyline. And you do bring it back, which is amazing.
And it's kind of like breaking that fourth, you know, the glass ceiling in a sense. I didn't want to push too much because you don't ever want to break somebody's spirit. You know, we all grew up with Disney. And however, in whichever way you get into foreign music, you get into music outside of the Western culture that you've grown up in, it doesn't matter in the end of the day. We need to be grateful that we can get access to it. But I do think that as the world goes on and as we start uncovering these stories, it does shine a light on, for listeners, how the music business used to work and how it's still kind of working in many of those same modalities. So, you know, I think that whilst the song plays as this inspiration and basis of the genre, it can also clearly be seen as the influence all the way through, especially to things like, you know, you mentioned, Greg, to Ladysmith Black Mambazo now. You mentioned how many years this song has an influence spanning. So as often as we want to revel in Disney's romanticizing so many of our beloved African artists, I would love to just go back to the beginning. And that's exactly where I started.
We figured that given the vignette nature of the book, it would be best if we went through some songs. This way we get to play a lot of music. We get to hear your thoughts on these songs. So we asked you for your half dozen, right, to guide us through the book and to guide us through a century of South African pop. So you were going to talk about Miriam Makeba next.
Yes. I chose Pata Pata, but you can listen to every and all of her discography. Miriam is the angel, the icon, Mama Africa. She is the meaning of it. And obviously the meaning of the song is Touch Touch in Xhosa. And it describes a really popular dance from the Shabines, which is kind of just the local watering holes, essentially, in the townships, the local bars. And they are run and frequented by locals. Pata Pata, what she says kind of, which I think I quote in the book, Pata Pata is the name of the dance, and she says it in the song, that we do down Johannesburg way, and everybody starts to move. And I love it. You can almost hear her smiling. Isn't that extraordinary that you can kind of hear an artist smiling in her own song? Because she knows Pata Pata can also have many other meanings, in that it could also mean black oppression, having to pitter-patter around, touch-touch, see-see. All of their emotions were oppressed, and especially during apartheid. And I feel like when she's smiling and she's reveling in the beginning in the song's bridge, that rich backing band ramping the groove back up just sets her, it sets the tone. You get to know her immediately. You don't have to, what questions do we ask? You know, what do
right.
we need to
right.
ask? She introduces mm-hmm. herself so beautifully.
Well, it seems to be that's a kind of a thread that you hear in a lot of the South African music that you highlight. There's this buoyancy to it. You feel lighter than air when you're listening to it. You want to dance, and at the same time, there's sort of a darker tone in some of the lyrics. A lot of it's coded because they couldn't, I mean, the government would shut them down, right, if they were, you know, they're living in this apartheid country mm-hmm. where people of color are completely shut down. Mm-hmm. And to express themselves directly in music would have led to consequences that they didn't want, so they had this kind of coded stuff in the music. And what you're saying about Pata Pata is amazing. How does a song like that, it's obviously an incredible song, but what was the pattern of South African music being taken and obviously Western culture taking it to a different place, but how did Miriam make that transition from being a local artist mm-hmm. to a international superstar, really?
Well, I think also from the outset, she had to flee. So physically and geographically, she had to leave because of her fervent activism, you know. And I think in terms of anchoring, if you just listen just theoretically, musically, that low piano chording anchors everything. And that it's relatable because we hear it in other styles of music. There's that tambourine, heavy percussion. There's that vocal track, obviously, first and foremost. But following on from what we were just talking about and Mabube, this was Kwela. So there's typically like a penny whistle or a saxophone, but her voice takes that place of the penny whistle. And I think that helped because music is visual, right? It's so visual. So taking out that penny whistle, I almost was thinking when I was writing the book that she replaced it. Also, maybe she knew it at the time. I wish we could ask her. But I think she knew that a voice, a feminine, strong voice, would reach places that maybe prior to her music, maybe it didn't. I also think that she, you know, she called it one of her most insignificant songs. You know, that's also the funny mm-hmm. thing about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because while it was maybe insignificant for her, it was so significant for all of us. You know, I quote in the book about how it gave a lot of Black Americans their first intro as well to African culture. You know, Tanisha Seaford wrote in her book, in, you know, when Liberated Threads, Black Woman Style in the Global Politics of Soul, that book. They said that by the late 60s, they had traded in certain hairstyles because it was now more common to listen to South African music. You know, Makeba's feminism had such a great impact. I think that's why it reached further than the borders of South Africa. You know, I think that family structures were such at the time that people of color were moved because of apartheid out of urban areas. So they were forced to travel really far to just work. And at times forced to then abandon their family, and mothers became that strong point, which is why typically I can imagine whilst the dad is working, many of the kids and the moms were listening to Mama Africa, their mother of Africa, Miriam Makeba. And mm-hmm. I think that as disastrous as that heinous political time was, you ask any South African and they'll look really fondly at the music that came out of there.
When we return, we continue talking about South African music with Lior Phillips on Sound Opinions. And we are back. This week, we're taking a tour of some of the great music to come out of South Africa with South African journalist and author Lior Phillips. Let's jump back into the conversation. Well, you already mentioned Ladysmith Black Mambazo, and So many Westerners know them only courtesy of Paul Simon. But tell us the approach you took, Lior, to this incredible combo.
Yeah, this is Ladysmith Black Mambazo. I chose Noma Temba.
Noma Temba, Noma Temba, Wangishiya, Selangretwa, Noma Temba, Noma Temba, Wangishiya, Selangretwa, Noma Temba.
And I think it's just such a prime, and I'm sure you guys will agree, it's such a prime example of isiKhathemiya, that style that's rooted in Zulu traditions that were largely, of course, it's all men standing together, largely a cappella. And this song, obviously, you know, that can translate to walk softly, which is quite an interesting comparison to the wild lion call of Mbube. It's sweet, it's harmonious, there's this tight unity, and I feel like it's a relatively safe choice for the government wanting to put it on the radio compared to wilder genres, you know, like jive, and it shared, because it shared roots with jazz, you know, as far back as the 1960s, at the formation of Ladysmith Black Mambazo, you can get into the genre so easily because you're attuned essentially to that style, because it's like a competition, right? It's rooted in these competitions between local singing groups. That's what the genre started out as, and the group has obviously featured so many rotating number of male vocalists, with Joseph Shabalala as the soul, I talk about a lot in my book, as a soul member. And so much has been written about Ladysmith Black Mambazo for good reason. It's the group's ability, like the namesake, it's the word for axe, Mambazo. It's the group's ability to like chop down competition, you know. And South Africans are so warm and so aspirational, and yet so intentional, that many of the storylines you'll see have quite a literal meaning. And I kind of love that. It's like, here's my axe. I'm going to chop you down with this beautiful vocal harmony.
You address in your book the Paul Simon Graceland album, where, you know, there was a boycott. There was some controversy. Some people thought it was a bad idea to make the artists and music makers pay for, you know, the sins of the government. Simon was persuaded by a couple of, I think Harry Belafonte and Quincy Jones, I think you mentioned, you know, said to him, you know, hey, you should do this, you know. And it did give Ladysmith Black Mambazo a second life, and maybe a new life in America. They had a number of albums following that. Where do you stand on that? I mean, what's your stance on Simon doing that? Because obviously the album was replete with South African references. He loved Kwela, obviously.
Loved it, yeah.
Is it an appropriation, or was it something that was helpful?
Well, I don't know if I have any right to say whether or not it's appropriation, since I'm a white South African. I think that that's also in terms of just what I feel. When I was growing up, it never seemed appropriate. And I do believe that cultural boycotting has its merits. And I feel like going against that in a time that many, you know, we didn't have social media back then. So no one was, people were reporting, journalists were reporting as best that they could. But as I was reporting, and I've written about it quite a few times prior to the book, especially with regards to the term world music and that terrible genre term.
Yeah.
Which I hate and am very an advocate against. And I think if you speak to any session musician who was a part of that record, or even just on the periphery of that microcosm, they will only say good things about being a part of it. Because that's the ironic thing about exploiting cultures, is that you put somebody in a position where, of course, they're going to want work, of course, they're going to do their best work, and then you're going to give them a platform. You can't look at Paul Simon and say that his love of this music is unfound and unfair. He did what he thought was best, and I think he did it in the best and most polite, quote-unquote, way he could. People were paid, maybe not as much as they should have been, but I think my thoughts are complex. My thoughts are still evolving. I think the more and more I uncover about the scenario in that time, I just wish I was a part of just the decision making as to why they decided to even do it in the first place. I understand visas, you can't just fly people around the world and get them out of the country where there's strife and civil war. But I do think that when you have an artist with that stature making decisions like that, it becomes very shaky ground. And I still believe that it potentially could have maybe happened after and or during things were getting better. And I don't think he was the lever to move it, but I do appreciate celebrating South African artists in every single way, and the way that he did it, I do appreciate it. What do you guys think about it? Like, when you were reading about it in the book and or reading about it prior to this, what do you think about that scenario?
I interviewed him several times, and the first time I interviewed him, you know, that record was still fairly fresh. He gave an explanation much along the lines of some of what you're saying in terms of the positive aspects of it. But there's no doubt that I think he put his music ahead of everything political. It shouldn't be political. Well, it is political because he did this, you know. You can't just skirt around it that way.
Absolutely.
You know, and I look back on the careers, like a number of those musicians that he used. I mean, he consistently used, those musicians were still part of his bands decades later.
Right.
I mean, they were touring with him. They said they were well compensated for their, you know, you're part of a huge band and a key part of it. And ditto for Ladysmith. They were... Mm-hmm. They did really well commercially in the United States because of their exposure on that record. Mm-hmm. So,
but you know, it's like the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, right.
If this is your gateway drug,
yeah,
to go back and to dig into Coco Taylor and right. Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, right? But then you discover Coco Taylor, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, and there's no reason to listen to Little Red Rooster by the Rolling Stones again. You know, fine, go to Exile on Main Street.
Well, and
something different.
There's nothing wrong with that.
I'll take it.
I mean, Paul Simon opened up my ears to a lot of South African music, and I don't think I've listened to Graceland in 25 years, Greg. I got, you know, like.
Well, I'm with you in that regard. The Stones pointed the finger back towards those blues artists.
Right.
I would not have known about some of those blues artists
right.
if the Stones hadn't covered their songs. So I come at it from a naive musical standpoint.
Where we all
Yeah. Right.
It's where we all come from, and I think that that's such a beautiful point, because isn't that the fascination about popular music? Where and how, who says how we can get into a room? Who says how we can get access right. into popular music? I don't say it, you don't say it. We just give people a vehicle and hope that we celebrate that artist's work and creativity. I love the Scandaloos of Africa, each and every one. Oh, mama, yeah. In their hearts a burning hunger, beneath the copper sun.
Continue this musical tour for us, Jaluka.
Oh my gosh. So I think they fit so perfectly here because it's called Scatterlings of Africa. Johnny Clegg was just the legendary icon at the time of me, especially growing up. He was known as the White Zulu, and he completely rejected strictures of apartheid. You know, even if you... We read about it a lot, but then you actually saw him doing exactly what he was saying within his music and within his media interviews. It never allowed him to ever hang out with black musicians, let alone even perform with them in those shebeens. And Johnny instead said, right, well, I'm going to learn then the Zulu culture. I'm going to learn how to speak it. I'm going to take it into my complicated childhood and let me grow from it. And this is fascinating coming right after speaking about somebody like Paul Simon, because Johnny Clegg was South African, and instead of appropriating right. something, he became it. And, you know, he and Sipho, who is still alive and well, who I interviewed for my book, Sipho Matunu, they got arrested a bunch, but, you know, they loved each other and connected in music. And Johnny became this star, and mostly he became a star in France, and I think he reportedly outsold Michael Jackson once. We love a king, we love a Zulu king, so I'll take that. And you know how popular Michael Jackson was, so was the biggest icon in South Africa, talking about international icons. So that was a great experience. And I think the reason why I wanted to include Jaluka as well is because there has been limited to no press ever and or biographies written about Sefo. And you're talking about one of the most acclaimed and talented musicians of South African popular music history. And it's because he wrote the music with Johnny, performed it sometimes, and then went back home. And that home is in a place that is, you cannot access it. You can't just fly into O'Hare International Airport, you know, and then access Chicago. It's not like that where he lives. And the way that I was able to get quotes was I got in touch with someone who then called his manager, which is not really his manager, it was his friend. And talking about separating the business, this man does it for every other reason than the business. And that is why this music is so bone tingling. You know, it's so the way that he sings and just how pop leaning this Scatterlings of Africa became, and how cool that is that we got to, it acts as kind of like the core to the record, you know, it's got synths and there's this like chorus structure that's got Zulu backing vocals. It was just an unmeshing. It was this mashup that we hadn't really experienced on that level before. So getting hold of him was one of my favorite parts of this. It felt like I was on the ground, and I sent questions, and I wanted to talk about his entire life, and he was like, we can't do that. But I love that he was available to talk about it, and so was Johnny's son Jesse Clegg, who's an acclaimed musician back home as well in South Africa. And he said something so beautiful that I hope I'm not misquoting, but he was just saying how it was his dad's personal favorite song, Scatterlings of Africa, from his catalog, because Johnny himself was a scatterling of Africa. Sefo himself was a scatterling of Africa. And, you know, Johnny was born in Manchester, then Africa kind of saved his life in many ways. And the song is how we originate from one place. Very fitting, as somebody who's South African, Cape Townian, speaking to you in Chicago, you know, we originate from a place, and then this mother continent, we kind of scattered around the world, but the music brings us home to that true story. And that's just so, you can't deny it. So I hate to get mushy, but you can't deny that that's just beautiful.
That song actually got a lot of commercial airplay in Chicago in the 80s. You know, again, it was one of those songs that sort of educates you, you know, about the perspective from a country where you didn't hear a lot of music on a regular basis through the typical mainstream outlets. But that song sort of broke through to another level. So,
I love popularity. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love that note.
It's fascinating.
It is fascinating. And especially, that's why we can, you know, cut this up, but I loved the opportunity to chat to the two of you, because I also think that there is a limitation to African music in the Western culture, and it doesn't box us. Just because you listen to one African song or a song from Africa doesn't mean that you are suddenly meant to know everything about the song, the artist, the country it came from. And I think we are getting better at it now. But a song like Scatterlings of Africa really, again, you used the word earlier, Jim, it's a gateway. It can get you then into Johnny's entire catalog and then go to other artists who adopted that same mode of creativity by, you know, not ignoring.
Well, is this why, Lior, you despise the phrase world music? Mm. It's like, you know, there's our music and then there's this other stuff from everywhere else. You know, I mean,
it's exotic.
I have so many college students who are obsessive now about K-pop, you know.
Oh, yes.
And I mean, it's like, that's not world music. That's their music.
That's theirs.
It's all our music.
It's typified in the name. It is Korean pop. It doesn't need another name. We don't need to be lazy.
Right.
We can actually...
Right.
And, you know, I think that we know why it originated. I'm not going to go into the history of that. I don't think we have time. It would be a cool conversation for another time. I think The Guardian has written amazing things. Let's go out for coffee and we can chat about it. But I think there's a part of me, and I hate to admit it, that I understand it. I really understand the need for boxing genres. And I think that's what's so fascinating about this 33 and a third series is that they are using subgenres to get you into a wider scope of music, which is why my book is kind of standing out in a sense. And I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, but it's because I couldn't just, when you speak of South Africa, you cannot speak of one face, one language, one genre. You have to speak about it all.
Right.
They all come hand in hand.
Right.
So, you know, he's singing like, I love the scatterings of Africa, each and every one in their hearts a burning hunger beneath the copper sun. Poetic. And I think that that's a beautiful way to get anybody into it. And if you want to call it world music, do it. But, you know, just make sure I'm not in a 100-mile radius of you.
Lior will kick your butt. When we return, more South African music you need to hear, including something more contemporary on Sound Opinions.
And we're back. This week we're talking about the vibrant music of South Africa. Let's get back to it. Each chapter has its own little playlist, which I think is a great help to a lot of readers who want to learn more about how fascinating this music is. And one of the artists that you wanted to talk about, Brenda Fassie, was one of my favorites. And I remember when she died in 2004 at age 39. There was this outpouring of just grief from notable figures around the world because she was such a important figure in that music. Tell us a little bit more about Brenda Fassie.
I knew I wanted to write this book because of Mary Makeba and Brenda Fassie. You know, she is this legendary artist who, as you mentioned, died at 39. She was kind of known as the Madonna of the township. I only remember, you know, we didn't really have like an Us Weekly or whatever. We had the You magazine, which was our kind of tabloidish, and she was all over it, but not because of her bisexual drug addiction nature. She was there because she was this provocateur that we loved watching. You know, when a provocateur at a time when Black South Africans, especially Black South African women, were expected to be secondary. And Brenda just said, absolutely hell no. She insisted. I love that. Even as a young girl, I watched her and I wasn't badly influenced by this woman gyrating on stage. I was enthralled. I remember so many stories of just watching her come on our local SABC channel and just seeing that there was somebody who insisted that she was going to be a star. She didn't say, I make music, want to hear it? She was like, I'm here, you need to listen to me, every single word. And where did that come?
You will pay attention.
You will pay attention. And where does that come from? You know, that confidence in the midst of coming out of an apartheid regime. And that moment, especially with Vulindlela, which is, I think it's 95, that moment was bringing traditional and international pop together, I find. Like, especially if you look at the contrasting pop stardom of Brenda Fassie and Yvonne Chaka Chaka at the two sides of the coin. And I got a chance to chat to Yvonne. You know, she was sitting in her recording studio and showed me all of her awards just lining her walls. I mean, we spoke for hours. And there wasn't one conversation that Yvonne and I had that left out Brenda. Brenda was part of every conversation. Mm. And that's her quote-unquote competition. So it just showed you how that Madonna of the township, she was crazy. She had drug issues. Crazy in the best way. I use that term very lightly. And celebratory. You know, that song especially, the reason why I chose it was because it may have seemed cliche, but it is a song of hope. You know, it's kind of telling people to make way, which is essentially the reason, the meaning behind it. and pay attention that, like, hey, my son's getting married, you know, like, it's sad in context, because if you knew the contextual history of that song, she did overdose not long after that. But the fact that she was so indebted to her own identity in a society that was forced to break that down just means that that song now, even it means even more now as a South African than it did back then, you know. And
a little bit of echoes of Kurt Cobain, I thought, while you were telling that story and while I was reading that chapter, right?
Oh, right.
Not a death wish, dies of an overdose, that dies by his own hand, but the lust for life is there in the music always.
Sounds so flowery and so floofy when we speak like this, but it really is the truth, because we are left now with that legacy, and thank God she put herself out there whilst being bisexual was not a common thing. You know, homophobia because of religious aspects is so ginormous in South Africa and Africa at large, and she broke down those stereotypes. And she just said, I've got this voice and you're going to listen to me. And it is so sad to, I wish she was here. Can you imagine when I was writing the book, I was just thinking, like, after I kind of touched on my chapter 11, which is more about current artists, I was just thinking how many of them look to her music and say that they have been inspired and or, you know, influenced entirely, and you just think, oh, I wish she was still around.
Goes on and on, the influence.
Yeah, but she gave us a lot, and I love that she went from the format of being in a band as a backing singer to the forefront, and that's why I think she has such a long-lasting legacy. You, no one can say that Brenda Fassie's music is not fun, even if it's dark and twisted in spots and turns. It's so fun. Yeah, and I love that also, Greg, you mentioned, you know, earlier about the playlists, because I think whenever I read a music book, I think authors try so hard. You know, you're writing in this medium that's on paper. You can't click. We can't click on this digital pad and send us to this, you know, automatic song. And I just wanted to try and get some gateway songs in there so that we can really enjoy just being able to, I think there's something really celebratory about arriving to a book and knowing that you're in a conversation and you're learning, as opposed to this is what you need to know, this is why you don't know it. So I think I wrote the book as somebody who would have read the book, and that's these playlists are just the beginning. It's endless. I would love to continue making them for the rest of my life.
I have a feeling, like all music lovers, you had a really hard time winnowing it down to just a handful of songs. You call it a micro playlist because you can tell, like, I'm really gritting my teeth that it has to be a micro playlist.
This is essentially a Desert Island Jukebox segment with Lior Phillips.
Yeah.
So we've been talking to you, Lior, about South African popular music, a generic title, a broad title, but one that comes to life on every page of this book. We could talk to you forever, but you're going to give us one more artist, kind of taking us up to the current day.
So the next song I chose is Black Coffee, who we all love, featuring Busi Mahlongo. It's called Isizwe, and this song, if it doesn't just grab you from the minute it presses play, I think... You know, Busi forged the way. Also, Busi passed away in 2010, and they forged the way of Maskanda. And I think that this, you know, this artist, Black Coffee, has become this global phenomenon. And you look at all the artists that we've chatted through over the last hour, and you see how somebody like a Miriam Makeba and or a Johnny Clegg and or a Ladysmith Black Mambazo, they whilst they are so well known, the Black Coffee reach is something we have never seen before. I mean, other than our, other than like Charlize Theron, you know, black coffee is one of the most, and our Trevor Noah, our own Trevor Noah, black coffee, you know, is one of the most celebrated artists right now. And he got a big boost of global attention from Drake, obviously sampling him. But then got actually, Drake decided, okay, I'm going to sample this music, but I'm actually going to bring him in. And he got brought into actually producing for Drake. And I think that that's another modern echo that comes in the form of Drake's 2022 album, Honestly Nevermind, because I don't know what it would have been if he hadn't been introduced to those producers. So I'd like to thank Black Coffee for that, and many other artists. You know, in 2022, Black Coffee got his Grammy for Best Dance Electronic Album for Subconsciously. It was a super, if I think about it now, it was kind of a moody record, you know, because he decided to go from kind of boppy-ish back in the day, like when he was DJing clubs, to his record last year pairing house and this kind of like romantic frustration. And I love the features that he called to on this record. You've got Usher, David Guetta, you've got Diplo, Pharrell. And it just showcases the reach of Black Coffee. And it is a jump. Look, we're going from Brenda to Black Coffee. There's a huge jump, and I recognize that. But for the sake of us discussing it, I think that it's a worthy jump to know that the reach that Black Coffee has had on the global stage is one of, he is now one of the biggest popular music stars, you know, in the world. And it all came from a love of local beats that he was making and hearing in clubs, in Shaveen's. And I think it just has brought this song especially, it really brings you into South African house further and further. And I think it's a great way to, if you don't know much about South African house music, but have a really large callback on house music in general, especially as Chicagoans, I think that Black Coffee is a really honest and perfect addition to any of your playlists. And I say this in the best way possible, easy listening. I can listen to Black Coffee at any part of the day with any mood. And that's not for every type of music. Believe me, when I'm down and out, there's artists that I turn to and they are there for me. And I love being down in the dumps. But Black Coffee somehow is that neutralizer. And he is so talented. And just thought, why do I need to stay in South Africa and play only? So he's traveled the world. And I think that access has gotten him, gotten other South African artists a lot of access, and I like that he's done that, you know?
One of the things I like about him is that he's taken this music internationally. You know, he's one of the big club DJs in the world, obviously, but he started out, there's a lot of South Africa in his music. I think it was a remix of a Hugh Masekela record that got him going. Hugh Masekela, obviously, another giant of South African music. But that was sort of the starting point for Black Coffee's career.
I mean, and the career and his music is emblematic of now the evolution of all those forms of genre. Kwaito, Xom, I'm a Piano, all using electronic music as that lever in that evolution. Mm-hmm. Because you look at something, if you want to, I look at Black Coffee as on a mind map. You can then map the evolution of all of the new and unique voices for Black South Africans after the fall of apartheid, and you can link him directly to that because he crafted a new language. He almost meshed that Kwaito rawness with that house lightness, and it was able to do it in a really commercial way. And I mean, you mentioned Hugh Masekela. I mean, now I'm like pulling at my collar, like, oh, I should have included him today. But you know, at least we're talking about him, and I got to talk to his amazing son about his life and his legacy for the book, which you can, I'm not sure which chapter exactly offhand, but, and I like that you mentioned that because I think that him sampling a jazz composer of that mm-hmm. stature was so smart, because it was also at a time where I think a lot of young artists weren't really looking at older artists as anything influential. They were like, we are going to pave the way to the new sound. And he was giving back and reckoning with where his own influences came from by doing that. And I think, how can you forget Hugh, you know?
Bonus selection from Leora Phillips. And okay, we could literally...
We could
literally talk all day. We'll have you back for another hour, and we'll talk about world music. That'll be a whole recurring episode.
That. Oh,
we get your blood pressure going. We've been talking to Leora Phillips, author of South African Popular Music. Thank you so much for sharing your passion. It just comes through, Leora, in every word you say.
Oh, I'm so appreciative of you guys. I just love your brains and all of the work that you've done. Real superior journalism from both of you, and it's been such a huge inspiration coming to a city like Chicago and knowing how local music has hit Chicagoans in a way that really I can relate to as a local South African journalist. And many of our passions, I think, align in that sense. So I'm just so appreciative, and just don't stop what you guys are doing, please.
That wraps up our chat with South African music journalist Leora Phillips. And now we want to hear from you. Leave us a voice message on our website with your thoughts so we can share them on the show. Mr. Cott, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, in honor of Labor Day upcoming, we're going to talk about songs about work, our favorite tunes in that area. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, it's never work doing this show, is it? The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.
Your mind.